We have here live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Starting out, I just want to give one more thanks to everybody that gave a gift last week during our fun drive. That was incredible.
Yeah, thanks so much to everybody, and for the folks who didn't give a gift but are going to next time, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Or people that just
much appreciated.
People that just tuned in and listened to the whole thing, that's okay too.
Yeah, and people who tune in and, you know, don't tune out again in horror, we really appreciate that.
We do. We appreciate
yes,
you staying with us.
So,
all right, so let's get started with this week's content, starting with inspection of rental units.
Yeah, the city council this week approved a new program for inspections of rental units. Now, this has been long in coming. At one point, the proposal was for the city to be doing literally drive-by inspections, where inspectors would just drive by, look at the outside of the building, and approve it.
That was the landlord's suggestion.
But the city council took testimony. They conferred. They heard from landlords and tenant advocates. And they came up with a new proposal that they passed this week. It was to change the current complaint-based system to a new program that requires registration and eventual inspection of all rental units in the city. It's a graduated registration process. Properties with 10 or more units, the bigger buildings, must register by July 1st of 2014. Units with buildings with 5 to 9 units will have to register by December of 2014, and people with 1 to 4 units by December 31st of 2016. So why, and I'm really not sure why they didn't just set one date, because you would think it would be a lot easier to register one or two rental units than it would be 100 or 200. I think they should have just set one date of July 1st of 2014 or December 31st. But why they gave people with 1 to 4 units, 3 or 4 years hanging out there without registering them, I don't know. But after a property owner registers the unit, they will then be able to self-certify, which means they will complete a checklist certifying that the units they have are up to code. And then the units themselves will be inspected within 10 years. But here's the kicker. The inspector would be hired and paid by the landlord, not by the city, although the city will provide some city inspectors that landlords can then choose to hire versus hiring a city-approved private inspector to do it. I found that kind of interesting. When you let the landlord hire and then pay the person who's inspecting the building, then who do you think the inspector works for? They're working for the landlord, not for the city.
And also the cost then gets passed on to the renter as opposed to the cost being covered by the city.
Yeah, and then there will be some enforcement of the proposal.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. There's a fee if you fail to register a unit. It's $1,000. But you know, slumlords already intimidate renters not to report code violations. So it'd be very easy for them to intimidate renters not to report to the city that they're living in a unit that's unregistered. Now the city is going to be setting up a registry.
And how many people actually are going to think to check to see if the units are registered in the first place?
Yes, they'll be setting up a registry for tenants to check. But the thing is you're going to have a lot of people in housing that's not up to code who don't know enough or don't have the ability to check the registry. You're going to have elderly people who don't always use the internet. You're going to have people from out of town. You're going to have people who don't necessarily speak English very well.
Yeah, you're going to have immigrants. You're going to have students and young people.
Young students who don't know the rules and don't know what to look for, you know. So I think that kind of self-enforcement by tenants is not the way to go, that it really should be a city-run program. Of course, then you have the question of cost and how the city would pay for that. Well, currently the city's saying that the cost of the program will be paid by registration fees and inspection fees. I think there ought to be some other better way to do it.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Also this week at the city council, they're talking about the budget.
Yeah, the city council's right in the middle of their budget session. The mayor has proposed a budget. about a week or two ago. And the city council is going to be looking at it, each line item, and deciding whether to make changes to the budget. So what they did is on their city council webpage, they've got a link to their budget page, and they put up a little link there where the public can weigh in on what their budget priorities would be. You go to the city council website, click on the budget link, and then read down to the link that says your priorities online, and click on that. And you can fill out a little survey where they ask you what's your top three and what your lowest three priorities are. But beware when you do the survey. It's a little bit, more than a little bit skewed. It asks your priorities, but it doesn't include several budget items that are typically funded in the city budget. It doesn't ask you to weigh in on whether you think administration is important, whether you think the South Lake Union Trolley is important, whether you think funding the mayor's office or the city council or several other of those type of things are priorities for you. And it does include things that aren't typically funded by the city, like, for example, public schools. That's, typically the state funds the public schools, not the city.
Well, the school district, yeah.
Yeah, the school district through a state process. The state provides some funding for it, and then the school district has to, through levies and so forth, get funding. It really has nothing to do with city government. So I think that's very interesting. It's an interesting lesson, I think, in how politicians can mislead the public about what they do and what the city can accomplish.
All right. Anything else on that?
No.
All right. Body cameras. Are they in our future?
Yeah. As part of the whole budget process, there was a little bit of a brouhaha this week on the city council over why Mayor McGinn didn't include any money in his budget for the Seattle Police Department to study adding body cameras to police
officers. Well,
there's
already websites like that all over the internet. I mean, what do they need more?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the dash cameras have been such a useful tool that now they're talking about body cameras on SPD officers and Bruce Harrell, city council member who really is pushing the body cameras. He thinks that McGinn is just not prioritizing it, even though a representative of the mayor's budget office sat in on the city council meeting and said, oh, no, we don't think it's legal in the state of Washington for police officers to be wearing body cameras, even though there are other police departments in the state of Washington that do have body cameras.
This is the same McGinn who stonewalled in the Department of Justice reforms and all
yes,
that?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, okay,
clarifying. And I don't think it's a priority problem, like Harrell says it is. I think it's more a not standing up to the police union and being too buddy-buddy with the police department. That's the issue as to why McGinn didn't include any funding for studying the use of body cameras in the Seattle Police Department.
But they are looking at implementing that system for
tracking gunshots, yeah, which would involve surveillance cameras and just kind of set up in various neighborhoods in the city of Seattle, constantly recording, constantly monitoring street activity.
All right, let's move on to national then, and computer rental companies.
Yeah, seven computer rental companies settled with the Federal Trade Commission in a very, very scary privacy case this week and I'm just going to explain to you what was going on, about 1,617 rent-to-own computer stores in the U.S., Canada, and Australia leased out computers to 500,000 people that had surveillance software loaded on them, and the software was called PC Rental Agent. It allowed the rental companies to turn on the webcam, intercept email, intercept bank account information, collect social security numbers, and even medical records of people who use their rental computers. Many people were recorded on the webcams walking around their houses or their apartments naked and engaging in sexual activities in the privacy of their own homes, and had no idea that they were being recorded and that this information was being stored by the rental companies. The names of the rental companies were Aspenway Enterprises, Watershed, Aaron's Sales and Lease Ownership, Showplace Rent to Own, Color Time, Premier Rental Purchase, and CALM Ventures. And those seven companies agreed to settle with the FTC, and the FTC will monitor them for 20 years to ensure that they do not use surveillance software in the future. It's a very, very scary case.
Yeah.
And it really, really makes you wonder, should I even have a dang computer in my home at all,
Well, and I have to imagine mm-hmm. there was some type of copyright infringement on what the NSA has been doing. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I suggest people, if you have a computer, whether you own it or you're renting it, no matter whose it is, that if you're not using the webcam, you know, cover
disable
it up.
Disable it.
You know, close the lid on your laptop, disable it if you can, or just put a piece of black electrician's tape over it. Cover it up.
All right. Okay, moving along. Immigration, the ICE.
Yeah, the LAPD chief, Charlie Beck, announced this week that his department will stop turning over information on illegal immigrants arrested for low-level, mostly nonviolent crimes to immigration services so that those people can be deported, unless, of course, they're gang members or they have a criminal record or that they've engaged in violent activity. And this is a very courageous stand because it really flies in the face of a state law, a California state law that was vetoed by Governor Jerry Brown this year that would have essentially done the same thing on a state level. The LAPD chief has really taken a stand and saying, look, this secure communities program whereby police departments are being required by the federal government to turn over fingerprints and other data on anyone they arrest who they believe may be an illegal immigrant. This is really causing a huge amount of friction between Latino communities and other immigrant communities and the local police departments. And we just simply cannot do our jobs. So
they have to be able to cooperate with those communities in order to get information on cases.
Yeah, in order to investigate cases, in order to handle violent crimes, and they're not able to do that right now. It's really been a total breakdown of communication, and this is the largest police department in the country to do this, and I think local police departments should be considering doing the same too here.
How local?
Can I say three letters? SPD.
Boy, and Jerry Brown's sure been vetoing a lot of stuff this year. I don't know if you've caught that.
Oh, yeah.
He's been, if there's a button for that, he's just been
pushing
riding
it
that.
Well, I don't really think SPD needs to do anything like that because their relationship with communities of color is already so good.
Let's move on. Study out this week on birth control.
Yeah, the free birth control study. It was a large study done by Washington University in St. Louis. They tracked 9,000 women over 2 years, offered them free birth control. Many of these women were poor or uninsured, and they wanted to see what the impact of that would be in terms of abortion rates and teen pregnancies in particular. And what they found was that in the study, they had 6.3 births per 1,000 teenagers enrolled in the study. Now, that compares with the national average of 34 births per 1,000 teens in 2010. So offering free birth control obviously cuts teen pregnancies down to one-fifth what the national level currently is. And
they're encouraging teens to have sex. Is that what you're saying?
No, they're basically being real.
That's an outrage.
Realistic, saying teens are having sex. Let's offer them some free birth control so that they don't have to have babies.
They'll stop having sex if we tell them in school to have sex.
No,
right?
That's been the current program, and it's been an obvious failure. Now, the abortion rate was very interesting.
They don't teach it well enough.
Shut up.
Sorry, I'm trying to play devil's advocate here, but I just can't keep a straight face.
No, you can't, because I mean, that's just a crazy argument, and reality bears that out. Now, abortion rates were also very much lower. They found within the study that they found 4 to 7 abortions per 1,000 women in the study, women of all ages, versus 20 abortions per 1,000 women in the national population. So it cut abortion rates down to one-third or one-quarter of what they are nationally. So providing free or extremely low-cost birth control has enormous impact for not just women's health and women's security. It also really truly helps to cut back on these things that are, you know, bugaboos of the conservative right wing. They say, you know, we hate abortion, we hate teen pregnancies, yada yada yada, but they don't walk the walk. They're not willing to provide the free birth control that it would require to cut back on those things. And of course, this study was no surprise, too, because this is what family planning doctors and nurses have been saying for decades or even generations. If you think back 100 years when doctors and nurses and other people were actually arrested for providing any family planning information to women, you know, we've come a long way, but obviously not far enough.
All right. Let's move on to this week in the alternate universe.
Yeah, in the alternate universe this week basically took over the entire national media coverage because it all focused on the debate between two of the presidential candidates in Denver on Wednesday.
Yes.
You know, I'm not going to do the who won the debate thing because, frankly, it's been kind of done to death. But there were a few interesting observations from the debate and where the debate what the debate tells us about the larger campaign and the larger political system that we have. The most interesting thing to me was that, you know, so much of the political pundit consensus on this was that Romney won the debate. And in fact, some of the after polls have shown that this was this was the popular conception too, although, you know, most of that was probably shaped by the pundit coverage. But it was primarily based on body language, on Romney seeming presidential and so forth. And there was almost no attention paid to what the two candidates actually were saying. So that, for example, Romney doing a complete 180 on the his statements for pretty much the last 5 years and portraying himself as a compassionate conservative, that did not go challenged. His saying that he had no idea that offshoring jobs resulted in tax breaks for corporations. that's demonstrably untrue.
And if it were true, it would prove his ignorance, I think.
Well, given that he was co-founder and CEO of a company that made their livelihood that way, I think it's
yes.
highly unlikely to be true. You know, Romney saying that his health insurance plan would cover chronic conditions and pre-existing conditions. So that is flatly not true. You know, his one that Obama actually challenged him on, the $5 trillion in tax cuts, he said he wasn't calling for that. Well, he has. The $2 trillion in spending the military doesn't want. Romney denied that, and it's simply all laid out there. So why you have this syndrome where rather than what's coming out of their mouths that actually would indicate how they might govern and what public policies they would pursue, we're worried about, you know, what their body language was and the tone of voice and whether they were staring at the camera properly or looking their opponent in the eye or
who
whatever.
Who was more aggressive?
Yeah.
You know, and who was more apologetic?
Right. And you know, is it a surprise that the primarily male punditocracy found that the, you know, very male aggression of Romney was appealing. Whereas much of the electorate does not find that appealing. It was very odd. And then particularly, this also tells us, as I mentioned, there are several candidates running for president that were not represented in that debate, even though on the ballot in most or not all states. And this debate was supposed to be about domestic policy. Well, it tells you just how much the parties are in agreement that there are huge sectors of domestic policy that weren't even brought up. The prison industrial complex, not brought up. Civil liberties and surveillance, not brought up. Drug war, not brought up. And I mean, you could just go down the list. It really is striking how little of the political spectrum of public policy is debated in these things, and within that, how little our political elite media seem to care what is actually said, as opposed to the trivialities of a TV reality show. So I would not take these next two debates terribly seriously.
Well, and what I found interesting about the debate, too, was the reaction of ordinary people versus the reaction of the pundits. Whenever I read or saw them interview an ordinary person, ask them what they thought and how they thought the debate went, a lot of people said, well, I was really dissatisfied with not seeing candidates put forth a proposal for what to do in the future to fix the economy or to help people. And that's really true for both candidates. Obama is running on his record what's happened more than he's talking about what's going to happen. And Romney is really running on, you know, saying Obama this, Obama that. And he's doing his best not to talk about his plans, because his plans would be a disaster.
Yeah. And there's, as I say, there's a reason they're not focusing on the future. Romney's is because not only would they be a disaster, but if people were aware of his plans, they'd be tremendously unpopular.
Yes.
And in Obama's case, he can't really talk about what he's going to do, because as long as the Republicans control one or two houses of Congress, there's not a whole lot he can do in the second term, and he doesn't want to be held to commitments that he can't honor. So neither of them really has an incentive to talk about the future, and media and debate moderators and whatnot don't hold them to it.
Yeah, and it's really the whole sideshow of our democracy is this focus on the presidency and this notion that the president has all this control, that even though the Bush presidency went a long way towards trying to gather more control and more powers to the president.
And it's not like Obama has walked away from that.
Yeah, there's certainly plenty that he can't do, particularly with a Congress that is not functioning the way it's supposedly designed to function. So really, the real issues are being ignored in this election year. And this year, Congress did far less than it had done during the whole 4 years of Obama's presidency, precisely because it's an election year.
Yeah, remember the do-nothing...
And the focus was away from Congress and on to the presidency.
Remember the do-nothing Congress under Truman that he ran in against Dewey, for people who know their American history? That do-nothing Congress only passed about 800 bills during... That was the previous record for least number of bills passed. This year they've passed 173.
Yeah,
so it's about
amazing.
A sixth of the do-nothing Congress. It's staggering.
Yeah, it really is terrible. And so, you know, this whole focus on the presidency and the debates is really taking us away from the issue of the real issue is that our government is not functioning at all. And that's the problem of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. By the way, the whole domestic, you know, issues kind of thing. Was there, aside from Romney saying that he supported alternative energy, which was another whopper, was there any mention of any environmental issue in that debate?
Yeah, no, I'm no,
just wondering.
No. And of course, that debate was supposed to be focusing on primarily the economy, they said, but the environment is really impacting the economy a lot. If you look at the amount of money being spent
to deal with
climate disasters.
Oh wait, that doesn't exist. Never mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's being put there by Satan to fool us.
And just all you have to do is mention the Midwest drought, and that's been a big hit to the U.S. economy.
All right. Also, voter ID laws.
Yeah, the courts in the state of Pennsylvania struck down their state's draconian voter ID law this week, which is a tremendous victory. Well, really, for anybody who wants to vote in the state of Pennsylvania, it had been previously litigated throughout the summer and early fall in order to satisfy a previous ruling from a judge. Pennsylvania had actually had to create a new ID that was supposed to be used exclusively for voting, and then what the court found was the state of Pennsylvania, which is Republican controlled, both the governorship and the state legislature, was refusing even to implement that law in a way that was accessible for people. They were doing very limited hours, long lines, and so forth. And so the entire law was struck down and reverts back to a law, the law prior to that, that actually, allows people to vote. So good news there. That really is the last of all the voter ID laws being litigated, with the election now only a few weeks away. So we'll see what the differences in turnout are between states that have some of the draconian new laws and states that do not.
Mm-hmm. All right. On international and Turkey and Syria.
Yeah, this week Turkey fired mortars into Syria. Now, you might ask, why did they do that? Well, Turkey said it was in retaliation for Syria firing mortars across the border into Turkey, one that killed a woman and injured several people in a building in Turkey. However, this has been going on for a long time. Syria has been shooting across the border at Syrian rebels based in Turkey and injuring Turkish civilians for a number of months now. Why did Turkey suddenly fire back this week? Well, and why did the Turkish parliament then sit down and approve a rule that said now that the Turkish government can conduct cross-border raids into Syria. Well, there's a couple reasons for this. First, Turkey has a very, as I said, a very close relationship to the rebels, and Turkey is views themselves as probably the only member of NATO that really supports the rebels. And secondly, Turkey is, I think, using this as a pretext to draw NATO and particularly the United States closer towards supporting the Syrian rebels rather than simply just providing some help through the CIA and ferrying weapons.
All right.
But it also makes it more likely that it will become a regional conflict rather than just an internal civil war in Syria.
Okay. Guinea. Weird.
Yeah. Interesting case study again in this past couple of weeks with from the West African nation of Guinea, which the good news is they've received $2.1 billion in debt relief from the International Monetary Fund. The bad news is that similar to how the IMF and the World Bank and other global institutions have been operating really for 40 years now, Guinea was forced in exchange for that debt relief, which again was run up by previous governments that you know were dictatorships and were not representative of their people and so forth.
With the help of the banking industry.
Very much so. Guinea was forced to cut subsidies for agricultural products and create public-private partnerships, that is to say, privatization, for government services. Now, Guinea is a very poor country. More than one out of eight children die before the age of five. Very, very poor health care, high infant mortality. And here we have the bankers in the West making sure that they can get their pound of flesh out of Guinea at the direct expense of the social services that will save their lives. So rather than Guinea paying interest on unsupportable debt, they're transferring money to the banks anyway just through another mechanism. That's called debt relief, and it means that wealth is still being extracted from this country just in a different way. This is how the legacy of colonialism works, and this is why so many of these countries are still poor, still economically ravaged, and still have very poor qualities of life after all these years after colonialism has supposedly ended.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, speaking of banks, cyber attacks against banks.
Yeah, there were some major cyber attacks against U.S. banks this week. The group that took credit is named Izz ad-Din al-Qassam Cyber Fighters. They claim that they...
Is there an acronym for that?
No. They claim that they're doing it because of the anti-Muslim video, the notorious anti-Muslim video that was posted on YouTube. But experts who are watching these cyber attacks, these denial of service attacks, are saying that they think it's being participated in not just by groups that are against the anti-Muslim video, but also by many hacktivists, that is cyber attackers with a political agenda, many of whom are based in Iran, and that this may be blowback from the U.S. cyber warfare that's been going on for years against Iran.
What are the chances that a virus like that is going to be developed in 2 or 3 weeks?
Yeah, not likely.
All right. Just under a minute left. Venezuela.
Yeah. Presidential election tomorrow in Venezuela. This may come as a surprise for many consumers of American media who just assume that Venezuela is a dictatorship. But, well, no, actually, it is a functioning democracy. In many ways, a more competitive functioning democracy than ours. President Hugo Chavez squaring off against the candidate of business interests and wealthy elite, Enrique Capriles. And what's really been interesting about this, whether or not you are a fan of Hugo Chavez, and he's done some things, in my opinion, that are very good and some things that are not, U.S. media coverage of this, and anybody who wants any example, there's an excellent story this morning in the New York Times that will tell you just what American media thinks of Hugo Chavez and who they're rooting for in this election. Very, very biased and really unwilling to entertain even the possibility that people might vote for Hugo Chavez because his policies have been good. They think his policies have been good for the country. It's kind of an inconceivable notion for elite Beltway reporters, it seems. And it's reflected in U.S. media coverage, which is very, very skewed and bad.
Events.
a number of them going on, several today, starting at 10 o'clock this morning. Solar Tour kicking off from Solar Washington starts at 10 a.m. at the Greenwood Library in beautiful downtown Greenwood. For more information on the tour and places they're going and so forth, www.solarwa.org. And then Thursday evening from 7 to 9 o'clock, David Corton and Marjorie Kelly, alternative economists and corporate critics, are going to talk about building an economy that works for all. That, again, at the Common Good Cafe, United Temple of the United Methodist Church, 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District. So we've got some things for you to do this week.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. We will have our election recommendations up in another couple of weeks, along with our print edition of the election endorsements and our usual glorious holdings forth. So look for that where you find free newspapers around town, too.
Yes, and you can find more of my material at mariatomczyk.com. And I will be updating it again soon. I've been in the process of moving, so there'll be new material soon.